Dan'l in the kitchen takes walk food. Dan'l in the kitchen talks recipes. Dan'l in the kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Dan'l in the kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we come to you from the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. Community Radio is a local treasure, and we're glad to be a part of it. Well, today on the Dan'l in the Kitchen, we're going to talk about an artistic event coming up. Mary Swander always has something going on, and we're going to talk to her today. We have, and with her is Shelley Buffalo, but they are going to talk about something that is really good. You know, we tend to have bad news coming at us all the time, and people don't want to talk about certain parts of history, Donna. You think it's a little uncomfortable, right?
This is a great story.
However, we
need to introduce Mary, who will introduce Shelley. So Mary is a very Iowa writer that we are so proud to call a friend of ours, and she is one of the best storytellers I know. You'll see. So she also does Ag Arts, which is a whole organization connecting artists with agricultural issues. And Mary's got a frog in every pocket.
Yeah,
so
she does Swander Woman Productions. She has a podcast called Ag Arts and Horse and Buggy Land, and she has this play. She's done other plays too. So yeah,
welcome, Mary.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. So I'm all of that, and Shelley Buffalo is more. She is here with us. And she is a huge bag of talents and interests. She is an expert in food sovereignty and rematriation of the prairie. And she's built her own house. She has, you know, she has, it's remarkable. And she's like, oh, just climb up here and I'll show you where my new studio is going to be. And it's just like a beautiful space overlooking the river on the Meskwaki settlement. And she jumped in and offered to be the set designer for this new play called Squatters on Red Earth. And so she is seriously at work here doing the beautiful, beautiful graphics for the cranky that she built, which is an old medieval puppetry device.
All right. Start by explaining the cranky, which is the structure of this new play, Squatters on Red Earth. Tell us about the cranky that, or Shelley can tell us how it works, and you can tell us about the history of the cranky, and then you got to tell us about the story that's in the play.
Yeah, no, I'll tell you just a brief outline of the play first, and then we'll go into the set. Squatters on Red Earth is a peaceful encounter between the Meskwakis and the Amana colonies in early white settler days. And they had a very interesting relationship. Of course, the Amana colonists took over the land that the Meskwakis were on, who then got pushed to Kansas on a really horrible reservation, and they longed to come back, but had no, you know, ability to negotiate the white man's world of money, and so the Amana colonists bought back the Meskwakis' own land for them and held the deed until the Meskwakis paid them back.
Oh, that's amazing.
What? Give us a rough date when all of these things were happening.
1855, and then that's when the Amana colonies landed or began. And it was just like a boom, and they set up their village and their shops and their tradespeople. And then the Meskwakis had originally been on that land, but then the Mana colonists purchased a piece of land, which is now the settlement. It's not a reservation. They bought their own land back, and they would come down in canoes in the Iowa River and visit their own old hunting grounds, and they liked to hang out in the Amana communal kitchens. The Amanas were a utopian society, and so they ate together in these communal kitchens.
The Amanas were German?
No, they were German. They were a persecuted group in Germany because they were pacifists, and then they were communal, and they had a kind of Protestantism that was stripped down of all, you know, bells and candles and accoutrements. So they were weird, and they got thrown into Ronenburg Castle with the gypsies and the Jews for a period of time until it just got, like, overcrowded. And then they immigrated to New York, and then that got overcrowded, their village there, and then they scouted out for, you know, other lands and came to Iowa.
So this is pre-Civil War.
Pre-Civil War. That's right. And so it was two groups who had no interest in interacting with the mainstream culture. And two groups that lived communally, two groups that were agrarian, that farmed. So they had a lot in common. And the way I structured the play was to show those parallelisms that occurred there. And then the trick about a play like this with historical context, it reaches, spread over 100 years, and how are you going to do that on the stage without it looking like a junior high school history pageant? And so I woke up one morning and I'm like, a cranky, let's do it on a cranky, which is, as I said, an old medieval puppetry device that's a scroll full of illustrations, and then you actually crank the scrolls. It was pre-film days. And then you have music. You can either have lines, people talking about what's, you know, acting out what's going on the screen, or music. And so we have both. So Shelley, with all of her many skills, carpentry skills, graphic artist skills, is the perfect person, and her knowledge of this story. She was the one that actually offered this story, which is hugely important. I would never, ever have known about it. It hadn't been for Shelley. Jumped in and said that she'd like to design and construct the set. So, Shelley, you want to talk about your role here?
Sure. First off, I want to say I am not an expert at anything.
Really good at a lot of things.
There's some stuff I'm good at. It's just that, like, I just have one of those brains that, like, really likes a lot of stimulation. So I'm always, like, picking up new skills. And so any of that stuff, whether it's building things or food sovereignty or, of course, with food sovereignty, you know, that's my heart work, seed rematriation. That's something that's very close to my heart. But anyway, with the cranky, this is, collaborating on this play with Mary is the first time that I had even heard of such a thing. And I was just like, what is this? So, you know, this puppets and this thing called cranky, like, that's really hokey sounding, you know? But of course it's just like, well, this is new. Let's just learn about it. Reserve any, kind of, knee jerk, reactions or opinions, and just like keep an open mind. So, as I started to learn about how this cranky device works and like the scroll and like, you know, it's like, you know, the pretty much all of the scenes get painted or drawn, or even sometimes, on the cranky scroll, it's, kind of like a collage, you know, with cutouts. And of course, it can be lighted from behind to have the shadow puppets, or you know, there can be very simple versions that are just showing the scenery, you know, as you turn the cranky handle and have the scroll advance. And when it came time to, it's like, okay, you know, we're going to have to find somebody to build the cranky right away. I was like, I'll do that. This sounds like a lot of fun figuring this out. And it was.
It's big, right? Like, how big is the cranky scene, for example?
Well, I think the screen opening is approximately 29 inches high by 40 inches wide.
Uh-huh.
So, the cranky box is like 48 inches high, and it's about, oh gosh, is it 48? No, I think it's 30.
Yeah, no, I had 48 to 49. I measured it one day. Yeah.
Tall. Yeah.
Because I had to get a golf bag to put the scroll in.
That's a good visualization. Yeah.
I had to get a very large golf bag with wheels on it for the scroll.
Good. Well, Shelley, this sounds like a huge, it's an enormous graphic design project. In other words, you illustrated 100 years plus of Iowa history. Tell me, did you start left to right and just go through and not stop? How did you attack this project?
Well, first of all, she said, Mary, you're crazy. You have 42 illustrations. So I had to slim that down. We're down to 17 now, but that's still a lot.
Is it a lot of painting on canvas? Is that what the scroll is?
No. So the material is Tyvek, not the house wrap kind, but you know, it's a, you know, basically it's like a polyester paper material.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes on a big roll. And that's another thing is like, I didn't know you could get this white Tyvek to do different stuff with, you know, it's like, people paint on Tyvek. You can use paint. The only thing is that, for most of these scenes, the shadow puppets need to show through. And so, Mary ordered these alcohol-based, art markers. And so it's my first time. Usually I'm more comfortable with paint, like acrylic paint, or I'm still working on watercolor. That's also like kind of a goal is to master watercolors. Please wish me luck with that. But I like paint, you know. And in fact, you know, funny aside, I was a house painter for years. I had my before I went into food sovereignty, I had my house painting business in the Iowa City area because it paid a lot better than, you know, working as a graphic artist.
mm-hmm.
And so I like painting. And so it's also a learning curve, like, you know, working on this Tyvek and figuring out, you know, getting used to these art markers. Like I said, they're alcohol based, which is like, it's cool rather than like Sharpies, which are solvent based, right? Because I did all the preliminary scenes. I did like a rough draft scroll for Mary and Rip and to rehearse with. So, you know, Rip would have the actor would have something in the cranky to work with rather than just standing there and cranking the handle on an empty cranky, you know. And then that was with the Sharpies, which are solvent-based. And let me tell you, that was like, you know, luckily I work right next to some open windows.
Ah, yes.
But these markers are absolutely wonderful. And, but yeah, like I said, it's a learning curve. It's figuring out, you know, which I enjoy, figuring out how to do this. Of course, we don't have months to get it done. We, all of us, it's amazing. Like our whole team, you know, we've all experienced setbacks. You know, especially since January is when we were, you know, really started getting rolling on having this all come together. So, you know, everybody's just gone through it and continues to, you know, it's like, It's almost like we're doing handoffs as far as like, okay, who's going to have a health crisis this week?
It's been incredible. It's just been incredible. But
it has.
We're going to pull this off. I mean, that's
yeah.
Well, tell us the dates for the performances that are coming up.
Okay, so it's June 9th at 8 p.m. at the Amana Performing Arts Center, and that's in Main Amana. And that's a beautiful big theater that used to house Old Creamery Theater, but now it's under new management, and it's the Amana Performing Arts Center in Amana, Iowa. And it's just north of Main Amana, so you have to get back on the highway for about 2 seconds to get there. Then the next night, day and night, is June 10th at 2 and 7 p.m., and this is in the Weeding Theater in Toledo, Iowa, which is the town nearest the settlement. And the Weeding Theater is an old opera house that volunteers in the town of Weeding, which is not very big, got together. Toledo. Not very big, and they got together and rehabbed this beautiful, beautiful old opera house, and it's a fully equipped theater. They have movies, films in there, and so we'll be there for 2 shows, 2 o'clock and 7 p.m. on June 10th. Now, the tickets are free. If you want to give a free will donation, we'd welcome that, and if you want to, it's open to the public. If you want to reserve your free ticket, because actually these performances are starting to fill up, you can email AGARTS office, AGARTS office at gmail.com and put tickets in the subject and tell me what show you want to reserve for, and we will have tickets for you to pick up at the door.
So your Ag Arts website has a page about the performances, right?
Right, and agarts.org, that website, and then maryswander.com has more information about the play. So it's maryswander.com. Both places have information. And then on my Mary Swander and Ag Arts Facebook pages, Instagram pages, and Twitter pages, I'm posting sneak previews, which people are really getting a kick out of them. So I've had a sneak preview of Shelley's Cranky and of Laura Hudson Kittrell's music. She is a composer and a musician. She composed 10 songs for this show. I did the lyrics and she did the revision of the lyrics and the music. She's beautiful, beautiful. Oh my gosh, voice. And so I've had a little snippet of her. And then Rip Russell is the main actor. And I've had a little excerpts from him. And then next week we're going to go over, start rehearsing with the Meskwaki Youth Theater Troupe. and we'll show little snippets of that. We have 7 middle school actors who are coming in with rod puppets and their masks, and they're taking on the roles of the Meskwaki lines in the show, and there are a couple little monologues in there.
Good.
So they're very enthusiastic and ready to go. So we're excited to blend them into the performance.
Oh, this is wonderful. Yes. And this is, I noticed in some of the information I have here that next fall, this show will be taken on the road. But this is not the first thing that you've done and taken on the road, Mary. It seems quite a task, and here you go again. Good for you.
Yep. We were dark for 3 years during the pandemic, and so we are sending Rip Russell, the actor, out on a tour. Right now we have, I think, 8 venues that are not all nailed down, but very live and wanting the show. And it'll be a slimmed down version. We can't tour with the youth because, you know, they have to be in school. And, but we can, Shelley made the cranky so that it folds up in the back of Rip's Prius. And we'll put the music on a recording, and we're basically sending Rip off with the show, and we'll teach him a little bit of puppetry. But we also have, I really had to search, it didn't have to search far, but, you know, I wrote the script, and then I showed it to some theater friends, and they read the script, and they were like, Mary, what are you doing? This has puppets in it, you know, and you're never going to get anybody to direct this with puppets. And I thought, oh, my God, I've committed some kind of mortal sin here with having puppetry in the show. And then I consulted with my friend Monica Leo, who founded Eulenspiegel Puppet Theater Company, and she said to contact Brant Bowman, who's in Oskaloosa. And I've actually been following Brant on his Facebook page. And I thought, what a creative, fun guy. But I'd never met him. And then I went over to meet him, sat down and talked to him. And so he is our director, and he was the perfect person. He really knows puppetry, and he's had some fabulous ideas and helped us shape the play. And you know, we're going to spend the month of probably June and July and re-jiggering it, slimming it down for the touring show, and he'll be very much involved in that. And, you know, that's a great thing, really. The best thing that came out of the pandemic was Zoom, as far as I'm concerned. And so we have Brant down at Oskaloosa, our costume designer, Michelle Payne Hines, is in Cedar Rapids. Monica did some of the puppetry. She's in West Liberty. So we're all in Eastern Iowa, but scattered around. And Laura's in Iowa City. We've been rehearsing in my little studio in Kelowna. But when somebody can't make it, they can then Zoom in. And it's worked out. It's worked out wonderfully well. As far as tours are concerned, I've toured plays now from coast to coast, and you know, I have this little theater company, but I don't have a theater, and all we do is tour and perform in other people's theaters, which eliminates a lot of expense and grief and rent and taxes and all of that.
Oh,
and
that works out great. We're going to come back and talk more with Mary Swander about this wonderful production, Squatters on Red Earth. But I want to take this time to mention you're listening to KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Thank you. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking to Mary Swander and Shelley Buffalo about an upcoming production, A Labor of Love.
A theater production,
yes, called Squatters on Red Earth.
So, Shelley, you found the story and told it to Mary. Tell us how you knew about the story and that the whole bit.
Well, I never knew the whole bit. You know, it just over the course of my lifetime, it came to me in bits and pieces just from my community here at Meskwaki.
So, the story is that actually folks got along for a little bit of time and are still getting along. Tell us about how you found out about the story.
Just little bits and pieces where, for instance, one of my friends mentioned that his grandparents would, make the trip to the Amanas to, visit along the way. Back before, automobiles, community members here would hitch up the horses and the wagon and take the family to the Amanas, which was a 2-day trip. And there was always, some friendly stops along the way for a little overnight camping spot. And so it's funny because when I go to Iowa City, I travel, along very close to that old trail in between here, the Meskwaki settlement, and the Amana colony, which I go through Chelsea and then Belle Plaine and then Marengo and then into the Amanas, through Tippin onto Coralville and, on. But that is, that's part of that is like the Meskwaki trail that, so there was, because that was our, where the Amana colonies are now was former Meskwaki villages. And of course, where Iowa City is now is former Meskwaki villages.
Hmm.
In fact, in Iowa City, there's a place called Meskwaki Park. It's actually an old dump. It's not a park. so it's it's kind of sad. It'd be nice to see, for instance, like Riverside Park, renamed Meskwaki Park, to be historically accurate as far as like this was a Meskwaki village, right? Iowa City. Different friends, family members, different community members here at Meskwaki talking about, their parents, their grandparents, and making that trip. And especially, if you look at the old photos, the Meskwaki were really fond of the Amana, woolen mill blanket.
Oh.
So I always wondered, where did those blankets come from? Because I'd see them in these historic photos and come to find out, I started asking around, it's like, those come from the Meskwaki woolen mill. And there was a lot of trade between the two groups. And so it's like, bits and fragments of this story over the years. And I was just always curious about it.
So it was an oral tradition.
Yeah, it was our oral tradition. Plus the photos are just remarkable. Especially the ones at the Iowa Historical Society. And Mary Bennett at the Historical Society did a full research project on the Meskwakis, and she sent me a file with just these incredible things in it. And, there are shots of Meskwakis in their wiki-ups, and they're wrapped in Amana blankets. And there are pictures of beaded couches and things, and that's what the Amana women loved because they were dressed in these plain outfits. And so the colored beads and the, you know, beaded dresses have totally appealed to them.
Oh, how nice. And, bling,
yeah.
Bling.
Yeah. And, yeah, out of bling, where the blankets, the Meskwakis love the blankets. So they, and then they had food, since we're on the food show here, they had food that they'd trade back and forth. Like the Meskwakis loved the manna head cheese.
And, oh, yeah. I like it, too.
And cracklings and, you know, things that you would never, at least I would never guess. So there was food traded back and forth as well as clothing.
Actually,
there's a guy at the, another historian at the Manna Colonies that I tracked down named Peter Hanley, and he got his PhD in history at Iowa State, and he wrote this just really, really well-detailed, beautiful academic article on this relationship. And then, you know, he had photos in that article of, like, the Meskwaki women going into the communal kitchens. It just takes your breath away. You just think, oh, wow, look at this. There was, you know, there was cooperation. There were people getting along. It wasn't all, you know, what we're fed in textbooks.
And Shelley, well, you have a tribal historian as well, don't you?
Yeah, Jonathan Buffalo is our tribal historian. And I just wanted to make a little note about how, just a little side note about the comparing the cultures with mentioning that the Amana women really enjoyed, you know, the you know, I guess what we'd call, you know, the applied arts, the decorative arts, the Meskwakis, in what they wore, their blankets, their garb, their jewelry, and so on. Interesting side note is that, like, you know, decoration and daily wear and even in, like, applied arts, like, for instance, in the pottery or in the, you know, any of the traditional things like the weaving, the beadwork, the ribbon work, all of it, is culturally, this is a, like, to reflect to our creator the joy of creation, right? To show joy to our creator. And it's a way of, like we're just really thankful and happy to have this life. And, you know, it's kind of, does that make sense? And if you contrast that with the Amana, who, you know, it's maybe, Mary, you could go into some of that, like how they were discouraged from even having flowers and things like that. Right, according to their culture, their religion, their relationship with God, you know,
their creator. It is fascinating. Their relationship was, you know, their principles were to be totally simple, to be stripped down. Yeah, they planted some decorative bushes out in front of their communal houses at one point, and the elders made them rip them out because they were too flashy. And so you can see, like, one culture had something the other culture really, really liked. You know, it was kind of moving back and forth like that. And then Jonathan, you mentioned Jonathan and Suzanne Buffalo. They were very, so very kind to me. And Shelley facilitated a meeting with them. And I got this just wonderful oral history with them. And Jonathan, like, widened out the story so that this isn't just a little story that happened in Iowa and everybody will forget it. It's like, this happened while we were in the midst of this bigger manifest destiny land grab takeover of the native land. And he really outlined that and gave me a lot of insights into how that developed. And, you know, the Meskwaki originally were a tribe in the St. Lawrence waterway in upstate New York.
Oh.
And they got, Yeah, and they got how they got shoved all the way out here and then even further into Kansas. And so he's a very learned man, really, and I'm debt to him, too, and to Shelley for connecting me.
This is an amazing story that needs to be told. And I want to get back to this concept of land grab. Somehow us folks from European background came over here and thought, oh, this must be all for me.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And they felt like
they just didn't work out that way. Unfortunately, because of aggression and guns and heaven knows what, a lot of nasty things happen. But this idea of the Meskwaki actually getting to buy back their land, I had heard that in the past, and I wondered, well, how much does it cost to buy back your land? And do you have any information on that? And the fact that the Amana colonies helped them do it. Do you have any information on what that cost?
I do have the figure someplace. I can't just pull it out of my head, but it was a sizable amount, you know. And when I was reading that, I was just like, what? We're going to buy back their own land. The whole irony and the, you know, configuration of this, it makes you want to cry. And, you know, the concept, again, of manifest destiny, of religion, how religion entered into this, how view of women entered into this thing, how the sense of entitlement entered into this. I read for like a solid year to get background on the issue, and basically I came away with, okay, we all have our paradigms and our ideologies, and we all think we're right in those paradigms and ideologies. After this project, I just think everyone should question every single thing that we've been told about anything, that we've been told this is the right way to look at this. Because there's always another side to it.
Perspective,
and you can often be really wrong. And so that's really the gist of the play. Like, how do we get locked into our belief systems? And what happened, you know, part of the show is about farming. The white settlers came over here and they were like, oh, this is great. Here's land that we can farm. But what are these natives doing on here? They're not farming. Well, they, hello, they had a very sense of farming and ecology, and they were doing things that we're now trying to imitate, although we don't give them credit.
Like, yeah, it's rebranded as permaculture, rebranded
right.
as regenerative agriculture,
rebranded companion planting, living mold.
Even rebranded, you know, as restoration and rewilding, and it's like it's just rebranding, you know, and
but it is. Yeah. And so, you know, and then all of these other prejudices enter in, like, you know, what are the women doing farming? Women are not supposed to be farmers. Men are supposed to be farmers. You get out from under this hunting and gathering thing. You need to, like, stay put and plow. They had a thing. They had a real thing about plow. And, of course, that just ruined the soil. And, you know, and then they were in the gender roles where, you know, women were supposed to sit at home and knit, I guess, and
cook.
And, you know, and that just really blew away the native culture. It was not a fit. Let's just put it that way as an understatement.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, and actually, you know, it's beyond gender roles. I mean, ultimately, it's the patriarchy, and it's about power. And you can make a direct link to the missing, the, you know, the crisis that is the missing and murdered Indigenous women, to colonization and the patriarchy, because, you know, at the very beginning, they saw that, you know, the indigenous women were the heart of tribal economy. They were, you know, and that was, of course, like, you know, much of that was through the land. And so indigenous women were not friendly to, you know, just signing over the land. And the colonists had to actually, you know, really intentionally focus on undermining that, right? And they did. They did. In fact, it still continues today in the form of the missing and murdered indigenous women's crisis.
Well, Shelley, you want to talk about, you also, in addition to this play, which is coming up, you are a busy woman, you are doing a field day for Practical Farmers of Iowa on June 28th about the rematriation of the prairie and those ways of cultivating prairie, which us white people would call prairie restoration. But tell us about that field day and what you're doing and how you use the word rematriation in that sense.
Yeah, so rematriation is, so I kind of segued into that really well with talking about just the feminine from the indigenous perspective. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, and how colonization wrought genocide, like specifically against the, and ultimately ecocide, right, against the feminine. So from our perspective, the earth is feminine. The earth is our mother, right? And because the earth is our mother and provides us with, you know, everything we need, as well as like shelters us from outer space, like Jonathan, the way he put it is like, hey, you know, everything's trying to kill us. Like, you know, we can't live off this earth. It's completely hostile, right? And so, we revere our mother. We respect our mother, and everything that we do is in respect to our mother, which is reciprocity, right? You don't give without, I mean, you don't take without giving back. We practice reciprocity in all things. And so rematriation, when we talk about rematriating the land, ultimately rematriating the earth, it is ultimately that. It is bringing humanity back into right relationship with the earth. Like, that is like the big picture. When we talk about rematriating the prairie, it is bringing the land, which of course is the earth, but the land of Iowa back into wholeness. You know, the land remembers. The land remembers everything. The land remembers what was taken. All of it. Like, when you drive out across Iowa and you see these tilled up fields, and even with all of the tile put in place, you still see where the marshy areas were. You do. And you still see where, on that barren land where, the washouts are, right? Where the water runs. Mm-hmm. Where, like I said, when there was once, you know, waterways, marshes, like so much of Iowa was like wetland. In fact, if you use your imagination and stretch it of how much life was here. And from my point of view, from an indigenous point of view, it's much of it is a barren wasteland now. It's like, you can't use the term desert because the desert is, a natural desert is full of life, right? This is like a wasteland. It's kind of been, it's been strip mined, of, I don't know, like 9 feet of topsoil in the last 150 years. So when we, this idea that this land was just wide open, uninhabited for the taking with a few stray savages, you know, that was the idea that was fed into the settlers so that they, you know, so that they were able to just come in and do this land grab and come in with that entitlement, right? And what's good about stories like this, Squatters on Red Earth, is it shows that the Amana colonists, you know, they were aware, they were conflicted. They also saw themselves in the Meskwaki because of, for instance, the communal society. And even that in adherence to spiritual beliefs, they saw that. They saw the Meskwaki as people. And so that is, you know, that is why, like, the Amana colonists tried their best to, you know, historically anyway, to practice that reciprocity with the Meskwaki in helping them to buy back their land. And the Quakers also played a part in that, because once again, the Quakers were a society that saw themselves in the Meskwaki. And I think that's really key, right? Is that you see yourself in the other instead of the other, the narrative being that the other is alien, and in the case of indigenous folks, that the other is lesser. But as far as rematriating the prairie, so how we stewarded the land is we didn't just take from it, we improved it. That 9 feet that of topsoil that used to lay on top of now, which is like clay fields in Iowa, that was from like hundreds of years of basically what's called controlled burns. Of course, like, you know, it wasn't as controlled as now, right? But very intentionally setting fire. And what that did to the land is that it you know, it regenerated, it put that carbon back in the soil and these incredible inputs back in the soil. And it also helped to keep the land in prairie and in oak savanna. And what that meant is, like, we had more large herbivores available to us, you know, for a nutrition source, because that open land is going to attract the elk, the bison, and, you know, when you have a heavily forested area, although there were woodland bison as well, but, like, you know, you have smaller animals like squirrels and rabbits, and believe you me, like, you know, a bison or an elk is going to feed a lot more people than a squirrel or rabbit. So that's just, like, very intentional relationship with the land, and not just, like, manipulating it to extract from it, but to be in relationship with it that actually is symbiotic.
Thanks for explaining that. The rematriation is an important way of thinking about our relationship to the land. We're talking to Mary Swander and Shelley Buffalo about a collaborative effort here. They are producing a play called Squatters on Red Earth. And just a minute, here we are listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Mary, in many of your other plays, you have something called audience feedback. I hope you have something like that planned for this one.
Yeah, we do. We're going to have a talk back after every performance, and different experts are going to come in at the Amana show. Peter Hanley, that wrote that article about the Amana and the Meskwaki relationship, will be there. And that's at 8 o'clock on June 9th. On June 10th at 2, we have Pauline Grabney, who is the biologist for the Neil Smith Prairie Preserve, and she's going to take part in the talk back. And then I've invited Jonathan Suzanne Buffalo for the 2 o'clock and the 7 o'clock performance at the Weeding. And Mary Bennett will be at the 7 o'clock performance. So, and then there'll be the cast and the crew, and you'll get to meet all these behind the scenes people that have been working so hard. And, you know, theater is, you know, a few big faces on the stage, and these people have worked amazingly hard, but then there's all these other people behind the scenes that you don't ever get to meet. So you'll be able to come. And, you know, what's really interesting so far is just getting the publicity out on this is people are starting to tell me their own. And this happens with every play I do, but it's really interesting with this show. Their own stories of interactions or intermarriages with natives or with the white people, or, you know, we have these things in our oral histories, and you know, this might be a really good time to write them down and to collect them. Because, as I say, it's not the usual stuff you get in your textbooks. It puts a human face on it.
Yes. This is a part of history that we need to know about. This is important. Do you want to give that website again where people can find out more about the play and more about how to see it?
Yeah. MarySwander.com, MarySwander.com. We have the information on there about where it's showing and then a description of the show, contact information for Janine Cosby, who's my touring director. She keeps us all straight and on the beam, and who's going where and when and what motel we're in and all those good things and where the check is, most importantly. And then information on how you reserve your free ticket.
Good, good. The play is Squatters on Red Earth, written by Mary Swander, with the help of a whole lot of other people. Thank you, Mary Swander, and thank you, Shelley Buffalo, for being on the Donna Lena Kitchen Show today.
Thank you, Long. Thank you, Donna.
Good to be
here.
We really look forward to seeing this extravagant and extraordinary production. I am so excited.
This is good. I want to mention a few upcomings here in the area. This weekend, a band, a musical group near and dear to my heart, is having the 30-year reunion. Barn Owl Band is having a 30-year reunion concert this Saturday. Find out more on Facebook, Barn Owl Band. And Story City is holding its annual Scandinavian Days, all sorts of parades and beer gardens and music. And I'm sure this is a traditional Scandinavian thing. They are featuring kumla and ham on a stick.
Kumla?
Kumla. Yeah, we have to go on. Donna, I'll show you what a kumla is.
What's kumla?
Well, there's a kumla right there. Anyway, go and find out more, because Scandinavian Days is a real fun way to start out your summer.
Oh, kumla is a potato dumpling cooked in ham broth.
Yeah. And how they get that on a stick, I don't
know.
We'll have to find
all
out.
Over the place, you know?
Very good. You've been listening to the Donna Lena Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday live here on the radio. You can hear it repeated at 7 p.m. Support this fine radio station, or we have a podcast.
The podcast. Go to wherever you listen to podcasts and put in Donna Lena, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, one word, kitchen, and there you will have us.
Very good. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
With excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.